So, Job 27, this is the chapter that causes the most contention with the commentators and the Bible translators, because it's one that sometimes gets redistributed to other speakers, but it's quite clear at the beginning of the chapter it says, Job continued his discourse. So we know it's definitely Job speaking. And this is what he has to say. As surely as God lives, who has denied me justice, the Almighty who has made my life bitter, as long as I have life within me, the breath of God in my nostrils, my lips will not say anything wicked, and my tongue will not utter lies. I will never admit you are in the right. Till I die, I will not deny my integrity. I will maintain my innocence and never let go of it. My conscience will not reproach me as long as I live. So Job effectively is taking an oath here, as in a sort of legal type of context. And he does so by swearing by the Eternal One, who seems to be the one who has denied Job justice in the first place. And yet we can see that in Job making his oath using God as his reference, that he's actually making the oath on God's authority, recognizing that it's God who has caused him the discomfort that he's going through. But he says, I'll never admit that to his friends. He's saying, I'll never admit that you're right. I'm never going to admit that what you say is actually the truth. And he says, I'll never deny my righteousness in this case. Therefore, Job is saying, I'm going to maintain my innocence. I'm going to strengthen my resolve to maintain my blamelessness before God. And my conscience will not have any reason to prick me for the rest of my life. Now, it's interesting that God uses adversity sometimes to strengthen our belief about certain things, that he will press the issue with us, but in doing so, he's actually digging our foundations deeper. So the reason that we know, Job doesn't know this, but we know this, that the reason that he's in the predicament that he's in is because God delights in his integrity, delights in the fact that he's blameless, and that God is using the circumstances to prove Job's faithfulness, to prove his delight in Job, but also to prove God's worth in that Job is not going to back down from his integrity, regardless of what it costs him. He's going to live rightly before God. Says in Scripture, God hates lying lips. And it would be easy for Job to just say, well, maybe you're right, but I don't, you know. But in doing so, he would actually not be acting in integrity, because Job knows that he's innocent, that he's blameless. God knows that he's blameless, but his friends are saying, you are the one to blame. So he's really strengthening this resolve, his trust in his right standing before God. And so it's actually Job's integrity that causes him to speak the way that he speaks, and his persistent hope is to be declared righteous by God. That's the thing that he's looking for, is that somewhere in the middle of all this, God is going to say, yes, Job, you are blameless, and that there'll be some explanation of why he's had to go through the things he's had to go through. And as much as he wants to be relieved of his pain, he's not going to compromise his integrity just to get relief. This would prove his accuser right, because he would be trying to please God for what he can get. So his friends are saying to him, if you would just confess your sin, then God will take the pressure off you again. And Job's saying, well, how can I do that? Because that would be lying. My words wouldn't be true if I confessed anything that I haven't done. So I've got to hang on to my integrity because that's what pleases God, regardless of whether God lifts this pressure on me or not. So Job's arguments now become, I guess, more forceful because his resolve is strengthening in the way that he's speaking. So in verse 7 he says, May my enemy be like the wicked, my adversary like the unjust. For what hope have the godless when they're cut off, when God takes away their life? Does God listen to their cry when distress comes upon them? Will they find delight in the Almighty when they call on God at all times? Now, if we look carefully at Job's words, he's not actually calling his friends wicked, although he probably has case to do that. But what he's saying, or what he's effectively praying, is that they might get a taste of what he is experiencing. Because then if they could experience what he's experiencing, surely that would realign their perspective on things. So he's saying, may my enemy, may my counsellors here be like the wicked, my adversary like the unjust. And the implication is that Job has become like the wicked because he's receiving the fruit of wickedness in his life, but he hasn't sown any wickedness, but he's being treated like the wicked ought to be treated in a retribution perspective. If that makes sense. So what he's really saying is that he's asking that they would taste what he's tasted, to experience a taste of what he's experienced. And really, the thing that Job is experiencing is that he is getting a taste of what Jesus is destined to experience. 2 Corinthians 5:21 says, God made him who had no sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. That is, that Christ, who is righteous, became like the wicked, and he received the penalty that the wicked deserve in order that we who are wicked might become righteous and receive the benefits of the righteous. As I said before, what we see in Job is that Job is really coming to an understanding of the cross. He's not coming to an understanding of what Jesus went through on our behalf, the things that he experienced. And in his prayer that his enemies would be like the wicked, he's really saying, you know, if you think it's such an easy solution, come and have a taste of this yourself. He's not being vengeful. Rather, he's pleading his case. As Romans 12:17 says, because if he was being vengeful, then he would actually be sinning. Romans 12:17 says, do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone, if it's possible. As far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Do not take revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's wrath. For it is written, it's mine to avenge, I will repay, says the Lord. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And so Job is effectively giving his situation over to God and inviting God to welcome his counselors into the same experience that he's had. Verse 11, he says, I'll teach you about the power of God, the ways of the Almighty I will not conceal. You have all seen this yourselves. Why then this meaningless talk? Again, Job is saying, if you knew what I'm going through, then you could understand something of the ways of God and how he uses his power. But after all you've seen, you're still full of meaningless talk because you've not experienced what I've experienced. So you can't know the suffering servant, Jesus, the way that I do. There's something about God inviting us into a participation with Christ that helps us to understand who he is and how he works. And if life was like the retribution principle says, where we come into relationship with God and as long as we do the right things, everything goes wonderful, we would never actually really understand the nature and the character of who God is. Because in his nature, he is a suffering servant. He's one who would lay down his life for his friends. He's one who is patient, and he's one who is long-suffering. And it's actually the difficulties of life that help us to come to know God better. That's where we really learn to understand who he is. That's why it says in Isaiah, when it's talking about God raising up Darius as the guy who would liberate Israel from the Babylonians, he says to him, I'm going to give you the treasures of darkness and hidden wealth, because it speaks about stuff that is rich in nature, but it's hidden in dark places, places where we don't really want to go, but when we go there, there's wealth to be found. And this is the place where Job is, and he's saying to his friends, you really can't understand God unless you've been through what I've been through in some way. And this next section from verse 13 is the bit that sometimes translators want to give to Zophar because it echoes some of Zophar's speech. But the context really is quite different. As we said before, it's not that what Zophar had to say in chapter 20 and what the other guys have had to say throughout the book of Job is not true. It's just that they're not speaking the truth about the situation. So Job says, here is the fate God allots the wicked. Their heritage a ruthless man receives from the Almighty. However many his children, their fate is the sword. His offspring will never have enough to eat. The plague will bury those who survive him, and their widows will not weep for them. In this context, the wicked are those who, like Job's friends, have rejected the testimony of the blameless one. Job has testified that he is innocent, that he's blameless, and that he's righteous, and yet he's suffering the fate of the wicked, even though he's righteous. And when Job describes the fate that God allots to the wicked, he's really describing the fate of those who reject the blameless Son of God, who experienced the penalty of the wicked, even though he was innocent, and reject his testimony. Jesus was abandoned by God on the cross with no family, so that he would become the firstborn among many brothers. So when Job is saying that the wicked, effectively loses his family, he's talking about the experience of Jesus on the cross. And as I said, the wicked are those, like Job's friends, who've rejected the testimony of God or the testimony of Job in preference for their either religion or self-worship. And so what happens when we focus on ourselves is that the ultimate consequence is to lose connection with family. And so I guess, you could say that hell is a place where there's no sense of family, because family derives its meaning from God. Family is important. It's part of the creation because God is a family. He's a triune God. And we have a loving father and an obedient son and the Spirit who brings everything together. And the penalty for rejecting the testimony of the Son of God is to step outside of God's family and his household. And so if we step outside of God's sense of family, then there is no such thing as family. And so we find testimonies of people who had visions of hell, that it's a very lonely place. There's no sense of connection with anybody because it's outside of what it is to be in God. And family is a very precious thing because it expresses the nature and the character of God. As I said, though, Jesus experienced this isolation. He said, my God, why have you forsaken me? This separation from family, this distance from his father. And he also stepped back from his family when he said to Mary, to John and Mary, that woman, this is your son and this is your mother, because he was about to lose any connection with family. Romans 8:29 says, "For those God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son, that he might be the firstborn among many brothers and sisters. And those he predestined, he also called. Those he called, he also justified. And those he justified, he also glorified. What then shall we say in response to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also, along with him, graciously give us all things?" So we see that Jesus was willing to endure the penalty of the wicked and be separated from his family so that we could be brought into his household as his brothers and sisters, that we would become part of his very family. Again, in Ephesians 2:14, we read this for communion. "He himself is our peace, who has made the two groups one and has destroyed the barrier, the dividing wall of hostility, by setting aside in his flesh the law with its commands and regulations. His purpose was to create in himself one new humanity out of the two, thus making peace, and in one body to reconcile both of them to God through the cross, by which he put to death their hostility. He came and preached peace to you who were far away and peace to those who were near. For through him we both have access to the Father by one Spirit. Consequently, you're no longer foreigners and strangers, but fellow citizens with God's people and also members of God's household, built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, with Christ Jesus himself as the chief cornerstone. In him the whole building is joined together and rises to become a holy temple in the Lord. And in him you too are being built together to become a dwelling in which God lives by his Spirit." So what we see is that through his body being broken on the cross, we have been brought into his household and we've been established in his family. Job goes on in verse 16, "Though he reaps up silver," speaking of the wicked, "like dust and clothes like piles of clay, what he lays up the righteous will wear and the innocent will divide his silver. The house he builds is like a moth's cocoon, like a hut made by a watchman. He lies down wealthy but will do so no more. When he opens his eyes, all is gone." So Job says the wealth and clothes that the wicked accumulate will be given to the righteous, and his house, his security, will be snatched away. And we see that when Jesus went to the cross, his clothes were taken, and also his wealth was taken. In fact, it says, testifying of Jesus, that Jesus testified of himself, "Foxes have lairs, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head," that he gave up his wealth, his security of a household and so on, in order to bring us into his household, as we just read in Ephesians. Because God is the true source of wealth. He clothes us in righteousness and invites us to live in his house. But of course, the wicked, by choosing to reject the testimony of Jesus, then become unclothed, as Job described in the previous chapter, that they're laid bare in death and that they have no possessions or no wealth to rescue them. Verse 20, he says, "Terrors will overtake him like a flood. A tempest will snatch him away in the night. The west wind carries him off and he is gone. It sweeps him out of his place. It hurls itself against him without mercy as he flees headlong from its power. It claps its hands in derision and hisses him out of his place. So the third thing that Job says about the wicked is that the terrors of the tempest, that is death, will sweep them away. And we see this image of death as a serpent hissing them away. And once again, we see the contrast where Jesus tasted death so that we could have life. So what we see is that Job's teaching is not, he's not affirming retribution theology, which is what some translators get mixed up with. That while what he has to say is very similar to what Zophar and his other companions had to say, the context of what he's saying is totally different. Really, what he's doing is he's pleading to his friends to change their belief so that their lives can be saved, so that they would come into a right relationship with God and not have to experience what the wicked experience. Colossians 1:22 says, "But now he has reconciled you by Christ's physical body through death to present you holy in his sight, without blemish and free from accusation. If you continue in your faith, established and firm, and do not move from the hope held out in the gospel, this is the gospel that you heard and that has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven, and of which I, Paul, have become a servant. Now I rejoice in what I am suffering for you, and I fill up in my flesh what is still lacking in regard to Christ's afflictions for the sake of his body, which is the church." So we see, you know, that really Job is pleading for the salvation of his friends, that because they've been so stubborn and that they have rejected Job's testimony, he basically says, "Well, I pray that you might be blessed to experience some of what I've experienced, because that would change your belief, that would change your understanding of who God is. And you would then avoid being swept away with the wicked and missing out on the benefits of the cross, missing out on of the benefits of the one who suffered on our behalf." That's why Paul in Colossians rejoices about what Christ has accomplished through his suffering on the cross, that he received the penalty of wickedness, even though he was righteous, so that we could then receive the benefits of righteousness, even though we were wicked. And so Paul says, "I rejoice in what I'm suffering because I'm understanding who Jesus is. I'm coming to understand the nature of God and what he's endured on our behalf." And he talks about filling up in his flesh what's still lacking in regard to Christ's affliction. Now, the affliction of Christ was complete. There's nothing lacking in who Christ is and what he suffered. But Paul's saying, as far as my understanding of the cross goes, there's stuff that's missing. And as I endure the difficulties of life and the struggles that I have, I'm being led into a revelation of who Jesus is. And it's filling up in my body what I still miss about what Jesus has actually experienced on my behalf. So chapter 27 is really quite a challenging chapter in a lot of respects, because it kind of brings all the issues together. And it challenges us. Will we hang on to our testimony about who Jesus is, regardless of the difficulties we endure? Because we're not looking for the stuff God can bring to us in this life. Rather, we're looking to bring delight to God's heart, regardless of what that means for us in this life. And as we hang on to that testimony through the difficulties, that there's this thing where we're coming to a fresh understanding of who Jesus is and what he endured for us, what he accomplished for us through his wisdom. As I said around the communion table, that God's ways are beyond our ways. The fact that Jesus came into Jerusalem to establish peace, not with a sword, but by laying down his life, is an incredible thing. No one would have conceived of that. That's God's wisdom at work, which is way beyond our wisdom. We look back at it and, you know, in amazement. Similarly, the things that God's accomplishing in our lives, we've got no grid to be able to understand what's going on there, but there's going to be a day when we'll stand before him and get some revelation of that, and our response will be that, just like all the others worshipping God, that, you know, they say, righteous are your judgments, you know, that you were true in what you did, and we would rejoice in the things that he's caused us to endure in this life because of the blessing that it's going to lead to in the next.